Jeremy Edwardson fronts the Myriad, and he's come to the Antidote for a chat. Jeremy, it's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
It's good to be here. It's good to be with you.
You know, I got to admit that I never thought that a talk like this would ever happen.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been a big fan of the Myriad from your early days, but of course the band disappeared for a long, long time.
Yeah.
You've got to be happy to be back creating new music.
Oh, absolutely. It feels good. You know, we took a long hiatus and I wasn't writing songs, and that was through a series of circumstances. It just kind of took the wind out of my sails. But this last year, through a lot of conversations with our original drummer, Scott, I just got excited to pick up the guitar and start writing again. It feels really good to get these songs out and enjoy a little bit of art again in that with the Myriad.
Perfect.
Are you from Eastern Canada? Is that right?
Yeah, I'm about 90 minutes northeast of Toronto.
Okay, right on. I have a soft spot in my heart for Canada because my mom's Canadian from British Columbia, so I'm half Canadian. So I didn't realize that's where you were calling from, but I can hear it in your voice. Yeah, this is great. The Myriad has done a little bit of touring in Canada over the years. I think we've toured Canada a couple times, played across the provinces, and yeah, it's always a blast.
It's almost like bringing you back home tonight.
Yep, exactly.
I should tell you that I always like to take an artist back to their roots.
Mm-hmm.
Day one for the Myriad was the EP, Until We Meet Again.
Yeah.
Now, a debut has to be hard to put together. So did the Myriad actually know right from the start as to what kind of sound you were aiming for?
Yeah, we kind of did. You know, before the Myriad, believe it or not, I was actually front man for a ska band. And some of the Myriad members were a part of that band. And at that time, I was listening to a lot of Radiohead and just things that were very far from ska and feeling inspired in that direction. And then I actually wrote the song Until We Meet Again and introduced it to the band that I was in. And, you know, the horn players all look at each other like, what are we supposed to play? And I think you guys are going to sit this one out. And then shortly thereafter, it was like, oh, man, we should start a new band, because it just a couple of the guys and I had sort of evolved in our taste and, like I said, what we were inspired by. And so that was kind of like the first song that really was the Myriad's, and the context of the song and even the name of the band kind of set the tone for what we wanted to do, what we wanted to write about, what our sound was going to be like. And so, mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, you look back over time as you put out music and there's like a healthy cringe that inspires you to do better and write better songs. But I still really love that song. You know, I think I wrote that song in like 1999 or 2000 or something. And it's, you know, it's a simple song, but I look back at like, okay, that was our first song. And it's exciting to have that be our first song and then to see where we've come since then.
It's definitely not ska, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So after a series of EPs in the early 2000s, you guys hooked up with Floodgate Records to release the Myriad's first full-length, You Can't Trust a Ladder. Now, back in those days, many bands were signing to Tooth & Nail Records. Did you ever give that label any thought?
Yeah, you know, we were actually kind of swimming in the same pond as a lot of those Tooth & Nail bands and playing at similar festivals. The way that Floodgate came about, it was kind of interesting because we had been playing like Cornerstone Festival in Illinois a couple years in a row. And I don't mm-hmm. think we were really on Brandon Ebel's radar at that point or anybody else for that matter. But we were, you know, very ambitious and making friends with other bands. So that year we played Cornerstone. Aaron Marsh from the band Copeland, and then Stephen Christian, I believe his name is, from the band Amberlin. Mm-hmm. They had heard us and liked our sound, and so those guys actually grabbed Tim Tabor, the president of Floodgate Records, and they said, you got to come see their show. And Tim used to front the band The Prayer Chain, and I didn't know Tim Tabor at that point, but I loved his band back in the day. And so he actually was drugged to the show by Aaron and Steven. And afterwards, Tim said, "Hey, can I buy you guys a lemonade?" You know, we're all 19, 20. I don't know how old we were, something like that. And then I guess we were in our early 20s, and we went over to a little food court area at the festival and sat down at a bench. And it was kind of like that moment from that movie, That Thing You Do, where Tim's like, you know, "Do you guys want to sign to my label?" And all of us are like, we're signing right now. There's a guy with a camper and he just bought us a lemonade. We're signing. And, so yeah, I guess that was maybe 2004, 2005. And then Tim actually became a really good friend of mine and has helped throughout our whole career, since then. But he was like our first label home there, Floodgate Records.
And Floodgate was a big deal back in that era. I mean, they released albums from artists like East West, Cool Hand Luke, Dennis and Mars, and Number One Gun.
Yeah.
So then by releasing music through Floodgate, did that actually open things up for the Myriad?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that helped with Floodgate was just getting us out on the road more. Tim put us out with bands like, you know, Cool Hand Luke, Mark Nix, what a great guy. And then we went out with, I believe, some of those other bands that you listed, the label mates. We were on tour with several of those bands and helped kind of expose us to a greater audience across the States. And then Tim also, he's a concert promoter as well. So he ended up getting us on a lot of different tours. And, you know, every time you do a tour and you introduce your music to new fans, the next time you play a festival, you're on a stage that's exposing you more. And it certainly did help elevate like our presence around the States and the world, you know, in some ways for sure.
Well, you know, I can personally relate to the album title, You Can't Trust a Ladder.
Yeah.
Because I fell off a ladder a few years ago and shattered my foot.
Wow.
But now you got to tell us, how did you choose that name for the release?
You know, I don't know. It's been so long. It's funny because I think at the time there was probably some amazingly significant meaning behind that title. When did that album come out? Almost 20 years ago. And the most significant meaning for it in my life now is like when I get on a ladder, I think about the irony of me being on a ladder and, you know, what the headlines would be if I like had a bad accident on a ladder. And so, you know, if my wife is, you know, every now and then you're coming up on Christmas time or those types of things. Hey, you know, can you clean the gutters or can you hang up lights? And I'm just looking at our house and grabbing the double extension ladder, just thinking, I hate doing this. and I actually did fall off a ladder about a year ago and got banged up pretty good. Didn't shatter any bones or anything, but I'm just sitting there laying on the ground just thinking, oh, that album, You Can't Trust the Ladder. And I don't trust them at all to this day.
Well, you know what? I want to pull in my most played song from You Can't Trust the Ladder, Stretched Over.
Mm.
And it showcases how great indie rock can be. Something else about the song is that the lyrics are kind of disturbing when it says, "She's barely clothed, ribs kicked in, our means ache giving in, hell stretches over me." So I need to know something. Is it okay for music to trouble the listener?
Yeah, you know, a lot of our songs were written in using a lot of metaphors and oftentimes delving into the mystery of the spiritual world. And even the name, the band, The Myriad, was taken from a chapter in the Bible, 2 Kings, where there was a prophet and he had his like sidekick with him. And there was a whole army coming after this prophet. And the sidekick was just terrified. And the prophet prayed, you know, "God, would you open his eyes so that he could see what I see?" And this his sort of assistant's eyes were open, and he saw, it said, 10,000 by 10,000 angels with flaming swords and on chariots, and it described a myriad of angels, and that's where the band The Myriad came from. But, you know, oftentimes in the Bible, there's sections where, it, you know, there's a dark reality, and then there's a light and a hope. And so we dove into that, and oftentimes the metaphors conjured up, you know, these images that are dark. And I think that can be something that I certainly think it's okay in art to go there. And I think that it can help people fully understand the hope of the world and oftentimes the despair or the dark places. I hope that answers it.
Oh, it does. And I'm also glad that you brought that up, because even though you guys are Christians, you don't really push a faith message. You know, it's more subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Doing that, did that make you more accessible to a mainstream audience?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that we discovered quickly as a band, one of our first shows in Seattle was at the Experience Music Project, and a guy came up to us afterwards, and he wasn't a believer, but he said it was really weird. He felt something almost supernatural or spiritual, like while we were playing. And those were the kind of conversations that really inspired us and told us that we were on the right track. And I think, you know, that God's in all of creation and the beauty of art and music. And people will go to concerts like Sigur Rós or bands like Radiohead, and there are such beautiful moments where they will cry and not know exactly why. And it's like, you know, for us to bring a spiritual element, but also in a way that didn't feel like we were pushing a message or an agenda. Ultimately, God's the only one that's going to like change someone's heart or give them inspiration or understanding of the greater reality around them. And so that was really what we were trying to do, rather than jump into sort of a Christian music thing and kind of push a message or whatever. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but I think it's a lot of it's more built for a Christian audience. And we definitely felt like this is just for everybody. And hopefully it can impact people's lives in a great way.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Perfect Obligation is another song from You Can't Trust a Letter that's always stood out for me. And it's a trace less, I guess, ambiguous, maybe you could say, than some of the Myriad's other songs, you know, because it says, "White out of grace to wash me clean, please. I can see you clearer from my knees."
You know, again, we're going so far back, but I believe that song was written from a place of struggling in marriage and that kind of a thing. And something that a lot of people experience. And that was actually a song that was very collaborative in the lyrics with some of the other guys who maybe were going through some things. So again, I would say all of our songs had a spiritual like underline to them, and that pursuit of God through these circumstances. And I believe that one was kind of talking about marriage in a way, but I have to go back and read the lyric and try to put myself back in that moment, because it has been so long. Yeah.
But the point is, with your band, is that finding God in the lyrics, you had to search for it.
Yeah, and some people took the time and did, and we love that. And there were other times, part of the interesting thing about being Christians in a band that wasn't necessarily catering to a Christian audience is you end up on more Christian-based tours or festivals, and there is some criticism that can come with that. And it just rolled off us because we didn't feel necessarily like that's where we were called to be. But there were times where, you know, we even had one time where a pastor said, "I just don't find any redemptive qualities in your lyrics." And we didn't feel like we needed to argue or justify ourselves, but we felt more confirmation that, well, we're not supposed to play on Sunday morning or Wednesday night at your church. you know, people are finding God and meeting God in clubs and bars and things. And that's what felt like a breakthrough for us on a personal level as we shared our music with the world, you know.
But you see, that's refreshing because so many bands did just play strictly Christian venues. They're there for the entertainment value. But when you go beyond that and play mainstream venues, then you're actually are making an impact.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of interesting because we, I would say not our final year, but close to when the band sort of wound down was 2008. And that year we won this sort of MTV competition. We were MTV's band of the year, and we had a video even go number one on MTV for a couple of weeks. And it was funny because, you know, it felt kind of like natural for us to be in that environment and doing interviews in the MTV studios in New York and doing videos with them and things. And a lot of those people weren't believers, but would ask us about the spiritual undertones of our music, and we were able to share with them. But it didn't feel like threatening to them or like we were pushing anything. And that was even again confirmation that, okay, we've stayed true to what we wanted to do and sharing God in a different way through our music. And, you know, just going over into that MTV world, it didn't feel unnatural to us.
And that raises the question then, did MTV discover the song, or did you actually supply that to them?
It's funny how that all came about, because so our guitar player at the time, his name is John Young, and he was sort of like the head of our social media endeavors and things. So he set up our MySpace account, and there were so many different things popping up, and some of them like would fail, and then some of them would go on to become the next Instagram or whatever. But this is way back when all of it was started sort of popping, Facebook and everything else. Mm-hmm. And he thought he created a profile for us on an MTV social media page. But what he didn't know is he was entering our band into a MTV Search for the Next Breakout Band sort of contest. And the rest of the band didn't even know that he had filled out a profile and uploaded a song or two. It was sort of this thing that he would just do on a lot of different new social media networks that were popping up. But again, it wasn't a social mm-hmm. media network. It was like a contest. There was about 4,000 bands that signed up. And out of the 4,000 bands, the team at MTV would pick their favorite 12. And those 12 bands would get two calls. And if they answered one of the two calls, then they get entered into the competition. If they don't answer, then they'll go to band 13, 14, 15, 16, and on down the line. So we were mm-hmm. one of the top 12 bands that out of 4,000, they thought, this band's kind of cool. Let's enter them in to the competition. So they called us, and we happened to be driving. I think we were in New Mexico. We were driving through the desert. We were in the middle of nowhere. We were on our way to Texas to meet up with a band for a 2.5 month tour. And John Young got this call on his cell phone in the middle of the desert, which always felt kind of like an odd miracle to me that we had reception. And they make the two calls back to back. So they call, if no one answers, they call immediately again. And the first call came through somehow in the middle of the desert. And they said, congratulations, we've selected you and 11 other bands to be in MTV's Search for the Next Breakout Band. And John Young was super confused. Wait, did we enter this? Yes, you entered this. Oh, I thought that was a social media page. And so that was how that whole thing started. And then from there, MTV's sent out camera crews that sort of followed us around to different venues on this tour we were on. And they were also following the other 11 bands. If you turned on MTV in that year, you saw commercials of us and other bands that were in this competition. And people could vote daily for about 3 months of who their favorite band was. And it narrowed down from the top 12 to the top 6 and then the top 3. And the top 3 bands go on to perform live in front of judges in the TRL, like MTV Studios in Times Square. And so we were one of those three bands. And then they, on the show, like reveal who the winner of the whole thing was. And that was the Myriad. And so then that was the winter of 2007. And then 2008, we were MTV's Breakout Band of the Year. So they had our songs playing during commercials for the MTV Music Video Awards. They had a couple of our music videos were actually on MTV, and then we had we ended up on all their little shows like The Real World and 16 and Pregnant and these different shows that MTV puts out. They would play our songs in the background, like a sync music thing, and it was.
Sure.
It was always kind of interesting. We had this one song called We Will Be Disappointed Together, and we never watched The Real World, but we tuned in because we heard we were going to have our song on it, and there's this couple, and they're just fighting and going at it, and then all of a sudden it creeps in, Tonight We Will Be Disappointed Together, and the song played for like 30, 45 seconds, and we were all jumping up and down, yeah, we're on the show. It was good times.
So you nailed it, and you nailed it by fluke. That's amazing.
Yep.
So I should explain to our listeners that A Clean Shot came from your 2008 album with Arrows with Poise.
Mm-hmm.
That was the year that, as you mentioned, that the band came to an end. Now, I do know the reason why, but maybe you can fill in our listeners about why the band closed up.
Yeah, so 2008, that was our big year, really, and we were on some pretty big tours, and, you know, every band grinds it out on the road, and then at some point something happens, and the band sort of breaks and goes to the next level, or however you want to say it, and that's kind of through the MTV thing that happened with us. And during that year, we were actually on tour with a band from Texas named Isley, and another band, mm-hmm. Videra, and we were at the MTV studios in New York, and we were doing an interview there with them on camera, and I was standing in front. Randy, our drummer, he was behind me, and then the guys were kind of all around, but Randy actually, during the interview, he collapsed and fell and knocked me down on the ground, and we all kind of went to him. We thought maybe he fainted from standing and the lights and everything, and then once he came to, he sat down and he said that he just experienced a really painful feeling in his shoulder, kind of upper chest on his left side, and it caused him to faint. It was so painful during the interview. And so he said, you know, while we've been on tour, there's some sort of a lump growing right here. And you could feel it. It kind of felt almost like an egg kind of growing on his chest. And so...
Mm-hmm.
We got home from that tour with Isley, and he went in for a checkup, and the doctors thought it was like a swollen lymph node, and so they gave him some pills to kind of take the swelling down, but it never did. It kept growing, and so then they said, let's do like an outpatient surgery to remove that swollen lymph node, and when they were in there doing the surgery, his wife actually called me crying and said, I don't know what to do. Randy's still in surgery, and they said that it was a huge black tumor, and they want to know if I'm okay with them taking his arm and upper left part of his chest, and I can't make that decision. I don't want Randy to wake up, and I'm the one that made the decision, and she asked me, what should we do? And I was like, I can't make that decision either. I mean, at that point, I was in shock. I was devastated. And I said, I can't, you know, you got to do what you think. You're his wife. And, you know, just trying to be supportive. But it was such a bizarre, weird experience. Mm-hmm. And so they ended up just sewing Randy back up, removing that tumor, sewing him back up. He found out at that point, this is probably August of 2008, found out at that point that he had a really aggressive form of bone cancer. Mm-hmm. I think it's called chondrosarcoma or something like that. And it was only really found in really young kids and then very old adults. So in the elderly and then really young children. And never in a 39-year-old man had they seen it. So they sent him to UC Davis, and this team came together to put together – a strategy for chemotherapy because they didn't know, they knew it was very aggressive, but they didn't know how to treat it in a 39-year-old man. And I think they probably thought we can go more aggressive than we would if it's a small child or an elderly patient. And so they ended up putting like a valve that went right into one of the main arteries that flows into the heart. Yeah, it was like a port, and it was a plastic port on his chest. And every 3 weeks he had to go into the hospital for 1 week, and they would basically drip this in and it would go into his heart and pump out really quick. They said, we can't go intravenously into your arm because it will burn up your arm. So we have to go right above your heart so it pumps quickly throughout your body. And that was kind of the first sign that, like, geez, this is almost experimental. And at that point we just, you know, the label management attorneys, everybody are calling, because at that point we had broken enough that we were sort of a machine, if you will. There's a next tour, there's a next studio time, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's calling and saying, you know, what are we doing? Are you guys doing tryouts for another drummer and that kind of thing? And the band and I were all like, we're not going to just replace Randy. We thought about our whole lives, and, you know, when the band's long done and we're, you know, in our 60s and 70s, we'll have no regrets about putting down our instruments and being with Randy during this time. But we didn't want to go out on tour and have a new drummer, and because I knew that we all knew that we would regret that, sending that message to Randy, who had been on the road with us, blood, sweat, and tears, one of our brothers, and he's back in the hospital, and it's like, hey man, good luck with your chemo, we're hitting the road again. It just felt wrong. And so we shut it all down, and Randy didn't want us to. I mean, he told us all, like, hey man, you guys keep going, you know, you got my blessing, but we just felt like the right thing to do was just to be with him and help there as he fights it, and, you know, pray and hope for healing. And in 2010 he passed away, and we were able to do one last tour with him, I believe, in 2009. We had an opportunity to go out on the road for about a month or two, and Randy's doctors kind of spread out his chemotherapy treatment so that he could, like, go on the road. So he literally had a treatment. Again, they last like a week. He comes out of the treatments like a total wreck, you know, because his body's just so beat down over that week. So he literally comes out of the treatment into the van. He can barely hold his drumsticks, but he's getting ready. We ended up driving across the entire United States.
Mm, wow.
I believe the tour started like in Washington, D.C. or something like that. And so he's kind of working on his chops the whole way there. And then, you know, we had an amazing first show, and that whole tour was incredible. And then as soon as we're back, he's back in the hospital fighting. So it was, for anybody that's gone through that, it was extremely difficult on his family, his kids, on all of his friends. And it's a roller coaster because you get, you know, through treatment, and then you hear, we can't find any more cancer, fingers crossed, we'll have a checkup again in a month. And you go back in and get your checkup and then find out it's now back and it's spread even further. So it's one of those things, you just keep praying and keep hoping. But it was just a hard couple of years. And then, yeah, he passed away, I believe it was November 5th, 2010.
Well, there's something else that ties into that, because I do have a story for you.
Mm.
A year ago, I made an episode of The Antidote that was titled, Why Didn't They? And it was all about bands that I thought should have made it to the big time, but they ended up disappearing. The Myriad was one of the bands that I featured. But now, here's the coincidence. A month after I aired that episode, what do you know? You guys released the single Signs.
Yeah.
And that actually ties in directly to what you were just talking about.
Yeah, it definitely does.
Was it difficult to record that song?
Yeah, it was. It's so when Randy passed away, I was pretty bitter. You know, it's hard to talk about, but I was bitter at God. You know, when you see someone that you're that close to and you're praying and you know that God can heal Randy or anybody, and then it doesn't happen. And we were with Randy, I mean, when he was in hospice that final week, we were there every day. He was a lot of the times just asleep from morphine drip and things like that, but we were with his wife and his kids on the bed with him, praying, telling stories about him. Every now and then he might wake up and join in with us for a little bit. But it was just really hard, and I got really bitter just at God. And one of the last conversations I had with Randy was about my grandma had passed away a few years before that, and my grandpa had received maybe 50 cards from different people at the funeral for my grandmother, and he went to read the cards at my parents' house a few days later, and he tripped and fell, and the cards kind of went all over the floor, and he started weeping and just picked them all up, and then he sat down, and the card at the very top was in my grandmother's handwriting. It said, "To Paul." And she described, like, how beautiful heaven is and that she has a new body and she's dancing in the streets. And it was, like, very out of character for my grandmother to have written that letter before she died. She wouldn't have done that. It wasn't in her nature to do that. So all of us were very confused as to how that got there, because it was talking about heaven and how beautiful it is. And so I told Randy this story, and he said, "I know what you're getting at. If there's any way I can communicate with you when I get to heaven, I will." And I said, "That's not what I'm asking." And we both kind of laughed, and he goes, "It's totally what you're asking. You just told me this wild story. Your grandmother wrote a letter from heaven and gave it to your grandfather." And I said, "Well, okay, say I am asking that, like, how will I know it's you?" And he said, "Just watch for the sign." And I said, "Okay." And about 5 years after he passed, I told my assistant, Andrew, who worked for me at my recording studio, the Soundhouse in Reading, I told him that I wanted to write again. And he said, "Well, I'll send you some, like, music to help inspire you, and just stuff that I'll help in any way I can." So he ended up sending me this one track that year, 2015, and Dropbox, which is like an online server, and thought about it until 2017, 2018, like right at the end of 2017, I thought I was going through Dropbox on a drive home from Sacramento, which is a couple hours away from my house. And I ended up seeing this folder called Songs for Jeremy. And I opened it up, and it was from Andrew, my assistant. And there was this file there, and I listened to it. It was just a simple chord progression on a keyboard with some drums. And I just started writing this song called Signs. And it was about that last conversation that I had with Randy, and it was about Randy's death, but then it was kind of this, the chorus says, "Won't you leave a sign for me, a sign to set me free?" And so the next day I had this friend that I'd been hanging out with a lot. His name is John. He's a doctor. And I showed him that song, and I said, I've written this song called Signs. It's the first song I wrote since Randy passed away. And he called me the next day. He said, "I hope this isn't weird, but you said you hadn't written a bridge yet for your song." And I ended up writing a bridge for it. And I said, "Dr. John, it's not weird unless it sucks. but let's get together and check it out." And it was strange, because he's a doctor, not a songwriter. And he said, I was up all night and the lyrics just came to me. You know, for me, I'm always curious about God and in these songs and in these writing experiences, what's he up to? And so I was very interested, even though it was so out of the norm. So we got together. The lyrics were just beautiful. They were perfect. And I started singing them out with a melody that I kind of wrote on the spot. And then we showed it to Andrew. And the whole song kind of came together right before Andrew and I were going on this trip to London. Mm-hmm. And I showed it to Andrew, and Andrew says, I love it. It's perfect. Let's keep going. Let's keep writing more. And so we had this trip scheduled to London on February 24th, and the night before the trip, the doctor friend happened to call me and said, hey, I don't know why, but I'm going to join you and Andrew on this trip to London. It was a week-long trip.
Wow.
And John's a doctor. He's very busy, has his own practice, and he cleared his books, bought a flight, and said, I'm going with you guys. I don't know why, but God wants me to go on this trip. Something's going to happen that's going to change our lives forever. And so we all got together and drove to San Francisco Airport to fly to Heathrow, London. And Andrew ended up having like heartburn, what seemed to be heartburn actually, on the plane, maybe an hour or two before we landed. And he was in the back of the plane with the flight attendants because it was getting worse and worse. And it was like 4 or 5 in the morning, US time. So we're all kind of asleep, don't really know what's going on. The flight attendant came forward and had asked if there were any doctors on the plane. And the only doctor on the plane happened to be John, who decided to come the night before. And he mm-hmm. went back and she said, he's got heartburn. He said, you're his friend. You're on the trip with him. You're the only doctor on the plane. And he asked Andrew some questions, and then he asked for an EKG machine. They put the EKG machine on Andrew, and John discovered that Andrew had a STEMI, which is like a blockage of one of the three main arteries or valves that go to the heart.
Oh, I see.
And so he told the pilot, hey, he didn't tell Andrew you're having a heart attack. He just kind of privately told the flight attendant, hey, let the pilot know, get this plane on the ground as soon as possible and have medical personnel there because Andrew is having a heart attack. And so the pilot ended up bringing the plane down an hour earlier than scheduled. When we landed, they told all the passengers to stay seated, and John wheeled Andrew next to me on a wheelchair. He was taking Andrew backwards through the aisle, and Andrew looked up at me and gave me a peace sign and held it up for a while, and I gave him a peace sign back. And he had like an oxygen mask on his face, and he had the EKG machine hooked up. So when they passed me at that point, I was like, oh my word, this is serious. Cause at this point I didn't really know what was going on. And so I said to the flight attendant, can I go with them? She said, yeah. So I stood up and I was walking directly, like basically Andrew and I are facing each other, and I'm walking toward him as he's being wheeled backwards. And as soon as they opened up the doors of the plane, maybe 5 or 10 medical personnel from the airport all came on. And at that very moment, Andrew had a cardiac arrest and his body kind of stiffened out, and he let out a long groan, and they lowered him down, and John, the doctor, jumped on him and started, started doing chest compressions. And the medical personnel, everybody jumped into, you know, life-saving mode. They all knew what to do. They had the paddles to shock him. They had the adrenaline. And Dr. John was kind of leading the whole team, you know, this many minutes of compression and oxygen. And then we switch off, and then at this timing intervals, we give him this many cc's of adrenaline, and then we give the paddles. I mean, it was like by the book, and they worked on him for a long time, and eventually they took him to the hospital, but on the way to the hospital, they were told by a heart clinic. And this heart clinic in London was like one of the finest heart clinics in the world. And they do heart transplants, and they have doctors that write books that are known around the world about the heart.
Wow.
And it was a Saturday, and the doctors had heard there was a seemingly healthy 29-year-old on the plane that had a cardiac arrest. But at the time of cardiac arrest, he was somehow surrounded by medical personnel that hadn't stopped working on him. And he said, this is a weird best case scenario, because most people have a cardiac arrest when they're at home in bed, or if they're at a sporting event or whatever, and no one knows what to do. But they said, wait, he had a cardiac arrest while he was surrounded by a medical team, and they haven't stopped giving him oxygen and pumping his heart. We can save this kid. Bring him here. So they took him right to this clinic, and they worked on him for, I think, about maybe 4 hours. And they had him through this like ECMO machine that pumps your blood and adds oxygen to it and everything. And really kind of every life-saving measure possible to save his life, but he didn't make it. And his parents flew out from California. They flew out right away, and they met with me, and the mom said, you know, we want to be mad at something or somebody. Like, we want to be mad that there was no doctor on the plane, or, you know, that there wasn't, that Andrew died like on the plane and no one knew what to do and all that. But she said it was like everything was lined up for him to be saved, for us to, like, you know, be with him right now. But he wasn't, and that it's like all of our questions were taken away. And in some weird way, as devastating as it was, we kind of saw like the sovereignty of God. Like, we don't get to choose the day that we're born or the day we die.
Mm-hmm.
But so it was kind of like this holy moment to be with him as he passed from this side of reality to the other side of reality. And it was kind of interesting, because it sort of redeemed the anger and the depression, the frustration I had with Randy's death, was somehow redeemed through Andrew's death, because I sort of was able to see Randy's death in a different light.
Right.
And, you know, the couple days after Andrew passed, the doctor was with me in this flat in London, because we decided to stay the week so I could produce this album that Andrew and I were flying out there to produce together. And I just wanted to do it to honor him. And we were sitting there talking one night, and Dr. John said, hey, I don't want to make this weird, but the last conversation you had with Randy was about a sign. And you guys were talking about, you know, if there's a way I can communicate with you, I will. And you haven't written a song since that conversation. The first song you wrote was written by Andrew, me, and you. And then we all got on a plane together. And as much as that song was about Randy, seems like it was also about Andrew. And the last thing that Andrew did before he died was give you a peace sign.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And it was kind of like this. It is like you watch like a good M. Night Shyamalan movie, and there's like that moment, the end of the movie, where you're just like, what just happened? Like, boom. And that's the way I felt when he told me that. It was like, whoa, was this song written outside of time and space? Was there like something in the supernatural going on that crafted this song in such a way that brought about redemption? And it was just kind of like this bizarre experience. But I didn't put the song out immediately. And like I said, a couple years ago, Scott Davis was with me and was encouraging me to write again. And I told him I do have one song I've written, and I told him what it was about, and he goes, dude, let's work on it. So we did. We put it out last year, and then since then, we've been writing a ton and putting out more material. So,
well, and that's what also led into your latest single, We Are.
Yeah.
And that was the funny thing, because I have to say, when I first heard Signs, I really thought that was going to be just a one-off song. And I got to say that your vocals on that single remind me so much of John Mark McMillan.
Yeah.
But anyway, another thing about it is that this is likely the richest sounding song the band has ever done. But then again, really, I guess you have to admit that the entire sound of the Myriad has evolved since the band's early days. But is this one the real you?
I think it's the evolution of me. You know, John Mark's a really good friend of mine, and I actually had got that feedback a lot after I released the song. So I actually sent it to him and just said, everybody says I was like drawn on my inner John Mark McMillan, and he laughed and said, love the song, bro. And so that was nice. But yeah, you know, I guess from a vocal styling standpoint, in the Myriad, I usually had sang more in like the tenor, but I really, I don't know. As I started writing this song, I was just in a different headspace and doing something different. And you never really know how that's going to be like perceived, especially when everybody has a certain thought of who you are as a singer and that kind of thing. And so I showed it to the other guys and they were like, dude, this is totally different. They loved it. And which was good, because if they all hated it, I don't know, I might be like, oh, maybe I'm not the best at the lower notes, but yeah, I mean, as far as if it's the real me, I'd say for where I'm at right now and just the way I wanted to tell this story of this song and the way I wanted to share it, it felt right. Mm-hmm. Certainly the sound of the band has evolved. There's new members now. But yeah, it still feels very connected to the heart of the Myriad, why we started the band and the context of the song and everything. I've never changed with that. From the very beginning, my heart and what I wanted to write about, what inspired me, has never changed. But the styling of the music has definitely evolved. I still feel like sounds like the Myriad to me, but it's definitely, like you said, it's a richer tone or something?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The song also shares about struggles. Spinning in doubt, we have grown far apart, but under your skin and inside your bones, I'm still chasing. I'm not fading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote this song from the perspective of angels, supernatural beings. I started thinking like real pragmatically about their job, if you will. And if you think about like the supernatural world and you think about angels and even in the context of the name, the Myriad, that Second Kings passage, mm-hmm. You know, they are with us. They're all around. And there are moments in life where they don't alter the outcome that you want. And those moments can be anything from somebody getting, I mean, this sounds really dark, but like somebody getting murdered, or even just somebody like I was talking about Randy going through cancer. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, there'd have to be some level of sadness in those moments for these protectors, for these angels. And it's all a mystery of when they're okay to like pull the trigger, so to speak, and change the outcome to save someone or to not.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And it just kind of hit me like, what a strange job. Like, you know, you're part of the kingdom of God, that you have, you know, these flaming swords and that there's moments in life where you're asked to stand down. Mm-hmm. But they're still there. They're with us. There's a hope there. In the chorus, I talk about that still small voice of God that you hear in the whisper or in between the waves. And then I talk about the rumble of God that you feel, you know, shake the earth. And so there's those moments on both aspects of God, the soft and the gentle, and then the strength and the awe, the might. And But yeah, in those verses, it talks about those moments where you feel like you've grown apart from God, but he's still there. He hasn't left. He's still seeking. And even if the outcome that you're praying for, that you're hoping for, doesn't come out, he's there. They're there with you, mourning with you through that hard time.
So with bringing out two singles, this leaves me thinking that, yeah, the Myriad really is here to stay. So what are the plans for the future?
Well, we actually are almost finished with a third single we're going to release, hopefully within the next month or so. And then I've got a song that I'm working on right now, actually. I've got a microphone set up here, and I'm working on the bridge of another song I wrote. So, yeah, we're fired up. The band's all excited, and we'll see where it goes. You know, it's right now, I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but I really am enjoying the process, and the guys are all enjoying it. We're planning on continuing to write and release songs, maybe an EP, maybe an album. But we're just kind of taking it one step at a time, one day at a time, and seeing what comes out.
Well, whatever you bring out, it's going to be awesome.
Thank you so much.
Jeremy, I want to thank you so much for this talk and for the music. It's been really great having you on The Antidote.
It's good to be here with you guys.